Hard upon seven. You must step out. Come, don't lag behind already, lazy legs.
Mr. Sykes accompanied this speech with a jerk at his little companion's wrist, and Oliver, quickening his pace into a kind of trot between a fast walk and a run, kept up with the rapid strides of the housebreaker as well as he could. They held their course at this rate until they had passed Hyde Park Corner and were on their way to Kensington, when Sykes relaxed his pace until an empty cart, which was at some little distance behind, came up. Seeing Hounslow written on it, he asked the driver, with as much civility as he could assume, if he would give them a lift as far as Isleworth.
"Jump up," said the man. "Is that your boy?"
"Yes, he's my boy," replied Sykes, looking hard at Oliver and putting his hand abstractedly into the pocket where the pistol was.
"Your father walks rather too quick for you, don't he, my man?" inquired the driver, seeing that Oliver was out of breath.
"Not a bit of it," replied Sykes, interposing. "He's used to it. Here, take hold of my hand, Ned. In with you."
Thus addressing Oliver, he helped him into the cart, and the driver, pointing to a heap of sacks, told him to lie down there and rest himself. As they passed the different milestones, Oliver wondered more and more where his companion meant to take him. Kensington, Hammersmith, Chiswick, Kew Bridge, Brentford were all passed, and yet they went on as steadily as if they had only just begun their journey. At length they came to a public house called the Coach and Horses, a little way beyond which another road appeared to turn off, and here the cart stopped. Sykes dismounted with great precipitation, holding Oliver by the hand all the while, and lifting him down directly, bestowed a furious look upon him and rapped the side pocket with his fist in a significant manner.
"Goodbye, boy," said the man.
"He's sulky," replied Sykes, giving him a shake. "He's sulky. A young dog. Don't mind him."
"Not I," rejoined the other, getting into his cart. "It's a fine day, after all."
And he drove away. Sykes waited until he had fairly gone, and then, telling Oliver he might look about him if he wanted, once again led him onward on his journey. They turned round to the left, a short way past the public house, and then, taking a right-hand road, walked on for a long time, passing many large gardens and gentlemen's houses on both sides of the way, and stopping for nothing but a little beer until they reached a town. Here, against the wall of a house, Oliver saw written up in pretty large letters, Hampton. They lingered about in the fields for some hours. At length they came back into the town, and turning into an old public house with a defaced signboard, ordered some dinner by the kitchen fire. The kitchen was an old low-roofed room, with a great beam across the middle of the ceiling, and benches with high backs to them by the fire, on which were seated several rough men in smock-frocks, drinking and smoking. They took no notice of Oliver, and very little of Sykes. And as Sykes took very little notice of them, he and his young comrade sat in a corner by themselves, without being much troubled by their company. They had some cold meat for dinner, and sat so long after it, while Mr. Sykes indulged himself with three or four pipes, that Oliver began to feel quite certain they were not going any farther. Being much tired with the walk, and getting up so early, he dozed a little at first, then, quite overpowered by fatigue and the fumes of the tobacco, fell asleep. It was quite dark when he was awakened by a push from Sykes. Rousing himself sufficiently to sit up and look about him, he found that worthy in close fellowship and communication with a labouring man over a pint of ale.
"So, you're going on to Lower Halliford, are you?" inquired Sykes. "Yes, I am," replied the man, who seemed a little the worse, or better, as the case might be, for drinking. "And not slow about it, neither. My horse hasn't got a load behind him going back, as he had coming up in the morning, and he won't be long a-doing of it. Here's luck to him. God, he's a good un." "Could you give my boy and me a lift as far as there?" demanded Sykes, pushing the ale towards his new friend. "If you're going directly, I can," replied the man, looking out of the pot. "Are you going to Halliford?"
"Going on to Shepperton," replied Sykes.
"I'm your man as far as I go," replied the other. "Is all paid, Becky?"
"Yes, the other gentleman's paid," replied the girl.
"I say," said the man with tipsy gravity, "that won't do, you know."
"Why not?"
rejoined Sykes. "You're a-going to accommodate us, and what's to prevent my standing treat for a pint or so in return?"
The stranger reflected upon this argument with a very profound face. Having done so, he seized Sykes by the hand and declared he was a real good fellow, to which Mr. Sykes replied he was joking, as, if he had been sober, there would have been strong reason to suppose he was. After the exchange of a few more compliments, they bade the company good night and went out, the girl gathering up the pots and glasses as they did so, and lounging out to the door with her hands full, to see the party start. The horse, whose health had been drunk in his absence, was standing outside, ready harnessed to the cart. Oliver and Sykes got in without any further ceremony, and the man to whom he belonged, having lingered for a minute or two to bear him up and to defy the hostler and the world to produce his equal, mounted also. Then the hostler was told to give the horse his head, and his head being given him, he made a very unpleasant use of it, tossing it into the air with great disdain, and running into the parlour windows over the way. After performing those feats, and supporting himself for a short time on his hind legs, he started off at great speed, and rattled out of the town right gallantly. The night was very dark. A damp mist rose from the river and the marshy ground about, and spread itself over the dreary fields. It was piercing cold, too. All was gloomy and black. Not a word was spoken, for the driver had grown sleepy, and Sykes was in no mood to lead him into conversation. Oliver sat huddled together in a corner of the cart, bewildered with alarm and apprehension, and figuring strange objects in the gaunt trees, whose branches waved grimly to and fro, as if in some fantastic joy at the desolation of the scene. As they passed Sunbury Church, the clock struck seven. There was a light in the ferry house window opposite, which streamed across the road, and threw into more sombre shadow a dark yew tree with graves beneath it. There was a dull sound of falling water not far off, and the leaves of the old tree stirred gently in the night wind. It seemed like quiet music for the repose of the dead. Sunbury was passed through, and they came again into the lonely road. 2 or 3 miles more, and the cart stopped. Sykes alighted, took Oliver by the hand, and they once again walked on. They turned into no house at Shepperton, as the weary boy had expected, but still kept walking on, in mud and darkness, through gloomy lanes and over cold open wastes, until they came within sight of the lights of a town at no great distance. On looking intently forward, Oliver saw that the water was just below them, and that they were coming to the foot of a bridge. Sykes kept straight on until they were close upon the bridge, then suddenly turned down a bank upon the left. "The water!" thought Oliver, turning sick with fear. "He has brought me to this lonely place to murder me." He was about to throw himself on the ground and make one struggle for his young life when he saw that they stood before a solitary house, all ruinous and decayed. There was a window on each side of the dilapidated entrance, and one story above, but no light was visible. The house was dark, dismantled, and, to all appearance, uninhabited. Sykes, with Oliver's hand still in his, softly approached the low porch and raised the latch. The door yielded to the pressure, and they passed in together.
End of side 5. Side 6. Chapter 22. The Burglary.
"Hello!" cried a loud, hoarse voice as soon as they set foot in the passage.
"Don't make such a row," said Sykes, bolting the door. "Show a glim, Toby."
"Aha! My pal!" cried the same voice. "A glim, Barney, a glim! Show the gentleman in, Barney! Wake up first, if convenient!"
The speaker appeared to throw a boot-jack or some such article at the person he addressed to rouse him from his slumbers, for the noise of a wooden body falling violently was heard, and then an indistinct muttering as of a man between asleep and awake.
"Do you hear?" cried the same voice. "There's Bill Sykes in the passage with nobody to do the civil to him, and you sleeping there as if you took laudanum with your meals and nothing stronger. Are you any fresher now, or do you want the iron candlestick to wake you thoroughly?"
A pair of slipshod feet shuffled hastily across the bare floor of the room as this interrogatory was put, and there issued from a door on the right hand first a feeble candle, and next the form of the same individual who has been heretofore described as labouring under the infirmity of speaking through his nose and officiating as waiter at the public house on Saffron Hill.
"Mr. Sikes!" exclaimed Barney with real or counterfeit joy. "Cabid, sir! Cabid!"
"Here, you get on first," said Sikes, putting Oliver in front of him. "Quicker, or I shall tread upon your heels."
Muttering a curse upon his tardiness, Sikes pushed Oliver before him, and they entered a low, dark room with a smoky fire, two or three broken chairs, a table, and a very old couch, on which, with his legs much higher than his head, a man was reposing at full length, smoking a long clay pipe. He was dressed in a smartly cut snuff-coloured coat with large brass buttons, an orange neckerchief, a coarse, staring shawl-patterned waistcoat, and drab breeches. Mr. Crackit, for he it was, had no very great quantity of hair, either upon his head or face, but what he had was of a reddish dye, and tortured into long corkscrew curls, through which he occasionally thrust some very dirty fingers, ornamented with large common rings. He was a trifle above the middle size, and apparently rather weak in the legs, but this circumstance by no means detracted from his own admiration of his top boots, which he contemplated in their elevated situation with lively satisfaction.
"Bill, my boy!" said this figure, turning his head towards the door. "I'm glad to see you. I was almost afraid you'd given it up, in which case I should have made a personal venture. Hello!"
Uttering this exclamation in a tone of great surprise, as his eye rested on Oliver, Mr. Toby Crackit brought himself into a sitting posture and demanded who that was.
"The boy, only the boy," replied Sikes, drawing a chair towards the fire.
"What of Mr. Fagin's, lads?" exclaimed Barney with a grin. "Fagin's, eh?" exclaimed Toby, looking at Oliver. "What an invaluable boy that'll make for the old lady's pockets in chapels. His mug is a fortune to him."
There's enough of that," interposed Sikes impatiently,
and stooping over his recumbent friend, he whispered a few words in his ear, at which Mr. Crackit laughed immensely, and honoured Oliver with a long stare of astonishment.
"Now," said Sikes, as he resumed his seat, "if you'll give us something to eat and drink while we're waiting, you'll put some heart in us, or in me at all events. Sit down by the fire, ye younker, and rest yourself, for you'll have to go out with us again tonight, though not very far off."
Oliver looked at Sikes in mute and timid wonder, and drawing a stool to the fire, sat with his aching head upon his hands, scarcely knowing where he was or what was passing around him.
"Here!"
said Toby, as the young Jew placed some fragments of food and a bottle upon the table.
"Success to the crack!"
He rose to honour the toast, and, carefully depositing his empty pipe in a corner, advanced to the table, filled a glass with spirits, and drank off its contents. Mr. Sikes did the same.
"A drain for the boy," said Toby, half filling a wine glass. "Down with it, innocents!"
"Indeed," said Oliver, looking piteously up into the man's face.
"Indeed, I..." "Down with it," echoed Toby. "Do you think I don't know what's good for you? Tell him to drink it, Bill."
"He had better," said Sikes, clapping his hand upon his pocket. "Burn my body if he isn't more trouble than a whole family of dodgers. Drink it, you perverse imp. Drink it."
Frightened by the menacing gestures of the two men, Oliver hastily swallowed the contents of the glass, and immediately fell into a violent fit of coughing, which delighted Toby Crackit and Barney, and even drew a smile from the surly Mr. Sikes. This done, and Sikes having satisfied his appetite, Oliver could eat nothing but a small crust of bread, which they made him swallow, the two men laid themselves down on chairs for a short nap. Oliver retained his stool by the fire. Barney, wrapped in a blanket, stretched himself on the floor, close outside the fender. They slept, or appeared to sleep, for some time, nobody stirring but Barney, who rose once or twice to throw coals upon the fire. Oliver fell into a heavy doze, imagining himself straying along the gloomy lanes, or wandering about the dark churchyard, or retracing some one or other of the scenes of the past day, when he was roused by Toby Crackit jumping up and declaring it was 1:30. In an instant the other two were on their legs, and all were actively engaged in busy preparation. Sikes and his companion enveloped their necks and chins in large dark shawls and drew on their greatcoats. Barney, opening a cupboard, brought forth several articles which he hastily crammed into the pockets.
"Barkers for me, Barney," said Toby Crackit.
"Here they are," replied Barney, producing a pair of pistols. "You loaded 'em yourself."
"All right," replied Toby, stowing them away. "The persuaders?"
"I've got 'em," replied Sikes.
"Crape, keys, centre bits, darkies, nothing forgotten?"
inquired Toby, fastening a small crowbar to a loop inside the skirt of his coat.
"All right," rejoined his companion. "Bring them bits of timber, Barney. That's the time of day."
With these words, he took a thick stick from Barney's hands, who, having delivered another to Toby, busied himself in fastening on Oliver's cape.
"Now then," said Sikes, holding out his hand.
Oliver, who was completely stupefied by the unwonted exercise and the air and the drink which had been forced upon him, put his hand mechanically into that which Sikes extended for the purpose.
"Take his other hand, Toby," said Sikes. "Look out, Barney."
The man went to the door and returned to announce that all was quiet. The two robbers issued forth with Oliver between them. Barney, having made all fast, rolled himself up as before and was soon asleep again. It was now intensely dark. The fog was much heavier than it had been in the early part of the night, and the atmosphere was so damp that although no rain fell, Oliver's hair and eyebrows, within a few minutes after leaving the house, had become stiff with the half-frozen moisture that was floating about. They crossed the bridge and kept on towards the lights which he had seen before. They were at no great distance off, and as they walked pretty briskly, they soon arrived at Chertsey.
"Slap through the town," whispered Sikes. "There'll be nobody in the way tonight to see us."
Toby acquiesced, and they hurried through the main street of the little town, which at that late hour was wholly deserted. A dim light shone at intervals from some bedroom window, and the hoarse barking of dogs occasionally broke the silence of the night. But there was nobody abroad. They had cleared the town as the church bell struck two. Quickening their pace, they turned up a road upon the left hand. After walking about a quarter of a mile, they stopped before a detached house surrounded by a wall, to the top of which Toby Crackit, scarcely pausing to take breath, climbed in a twinkling.
"The boy next," said Toby. "Hoist him up. I'll catch hold of him."
Before Oliver had time to look round, Sikes had caught him under the arms, and in 3 or 4 seconds he and Toby were lying on the grass on the other side. Sikes followed directly, and they stole cautiously towards the house. And now, for the first time, Oliver, well-nigh mad with grief and terror, saw that housebreaking and robbery, if not murder, were the objects of the expedition. He clasped his hands together and involuntarily uttered a subdued exclamation of horror. A mist came before his eyes, the cold sweat stood upon his ashy face, his limbs failed him, and he sank upon his knees.
"Get up," murmured Sikes, trembling with rage, and drawing the pistol from his pocket. "Get up, or I'll strew your brains upon the grass."
"Oh, for God's sake, let me go," cried Oliver. "Let me run away and die in the fields. I will never come near London. Never, never. Oh, pray have mercy on me, and do not make me steal. For the love of all the bright angels that rest in heaven, have mercy upon me."
The man to whom this appeal was made swore a dreadful oath, and had cocked the pistol, when Toby, striking it from his grasp, placed his hand upon the boy's mouth and dragged him to the house.
"Hush!" cried the man. "It won't answer here. Say another word and I'll do your business myself with a crack on the head. That makes no noise, and is quite as certain and more genteel. Here, Bill, wrench the shutter open. He's game enough, now I'll engage. I've seen older hands of his age took the same way for a minute or two on a cold night."
Sikes, invoking terrific imprecations upon Fagin's head for sending Oliver on such an errand, plied the crowbar vigorously, but with little noise. After some delay and some assistance from Toby, the shutter to which he had referred swung open on its hinges. It was a little lattice window, about 5 feet and a half above the ground, at the back of the house, which belonged to a scullery or small brewing place at the end of the passage. The aperture was so small that the inmates had probably not thought it worthwhile to defend it more securely, but it was large enough to admit a boy of Oliver's size, nevertheless. A very brief exercise of Mr. Sykes's art sufficed to overcome the fastening of the lattice, and it soon stood wide open also.
"Now listen, you young limb," whispered Sykes, drawing a dark lantern from his pocket and throwing the glare full on Oliver's face. "I'm going to put you through there. Take this light, go softly up the steps straight afore you, and along the little hall to the street door, unfasten it, and let us in."
"There's a bolt at the top you won't be able to reach," interposed Toby. "Stand upon one of the hall chairs. There are three there, Bill, with a jolly large blue unicorn and gold pitchfork on 'em, which is the old lady's arms."
"Keep quiet, can't you?" replied Sykes with a threatening look. "The room door is open, is it?"
"Wide," replied Toby, after peeping in to satisfy himself. "The game of that is that they always leave it open with a catch, so that the dog, who's got a bed in here, may walk up and down the passage when he feels wakeful. Barney ticed him away tonight. So neat."
Although Mr. Crackit spoke in a scarcely audible whisper and laughed without noise, Sykes imperiously commanded him to be silent and to get to work. Toby complied by first producing his lantern and placing it on the ground. Then, by planting himself firmly with his head against the wall beneath the window and his hands upon his knees, so as to make a step of his back. This was no sooner done than Sykes, mounting upon him, put Oliver gently through the window with his feet first, and, without leaving hold of his collar, planted him safely on the floor inside.
"Take this lantern," said Sykes, looking into the room. "You see the stairs afore you?"
Oliver, more dead than alive, gasped out, "Yes." Sykes, pointing to the street door with a pistol barrel, briefly advised him to take notice that he was within shot all the way, and that if he faltered, he would fall dead that instant.
"It's done in a minute," said Sykes, in the same low whisper. "Directly I leave go of you, do your work. Hark! What's that?"
whispered the other man.
They listened intently.
"Nothing," said Sykes, releasing his hold of Oliver. "Now!"
In the short time he had had to collect his senses, the boy had firmly resolved that whether he died in the attempt or not, he would make one effort to dart upstairs from the hall and alarm the family. Filled with this idea, he advanced at once, but stealthily.
"Come back!" suddenly cried Sykes aloud. "Back! Back!"
Scared by the sudden breaking of the dead stillness of the place, and by a loud cry which followed it, Oliver let his lantern fall, and knew not whether to advance or fly. The cry was repeated. A light appeared. A vision of two terrified, half-dressed men at the top of the stairs swam before his eyes. A flash, a loud noise, a smoke, a crash somewhere, but where he knew not, and he staggered back. Sykes had disappeared for an instant, but he was up again and had him by the collar before the smoke had cleared away. He fired his own pistol after the men, who were already retreating, and dragged the boy up.
"Clasp your arm tighter," said Sykes, as he drew him through the window. "Give me a shawl here. They've hit him. Quick! Oh, damnation, how the boy bleeds!"
Then came the loud ringing of a bell, mingled with the noise of firearms, and the shouts of men, and the sensation of being carried over uneven ground at a rapid pace. And then the noises grew confused in the distance, and a cold, deadly feeling crept over the boy's heart, and he saw or heard no more. Chapter 23, which contains the substance of a pleasant conversation between Mr. Bumble and a lady, and shows that even a beadle may be susceptible on some points. The night was bitter cold. The snow lay on the ground, frozen into a hard, thick crust, so that only the heaps that had drifted into byways and corners were affected by the sharp wind that howled abroad, which, as if expending increased fury on such prey as it found, caught it savagely up in clouds, and whirling it into a thousand misty eddies, scattered it in air. Bleak, dark, and piercing cold, it was a night for the well-housed and fed to draw round the bright fire and thank God they were at home, and for the homeless, starving wretch to lay him down and die. Many hunger-worn outcasts close their eyes in our bare streets at such times, who, let their crimes have been what they may, can hardly open them in a more bitter world. Such was the aspect of out-of-doors affairs when Mrs. Corney, the matron of the workhouse to which our readers have been already introduced as the birthplace of Oliver Twist, sat herself down before a cheerful fire in her own little room and glanced with no small degree of complacency at a small round table on which stood a tray of corresponding size furnished with all necessary materials for the most grateful meal that matrons enjoy. In fact, Mrs. Corney was about to solace herself with a cup of tea. As she glanced from the table to the fireplace, where the smallest of all possible kettles was singing a small song in a small voice, her inward satisfaction evidently increased. So much so, indeed, that Mrs. Corney smiled. "Well," said the matron, leaning her elbow on the table and looking reflectively at the fire, "I'm sure we have all on us a great deal to be grateful for, a great deal if we did but know it. Ah!" Mrs. Corney shook her head mournfully, as if deploring the mental blindness of those paupers who did not know it, and thrusting a silver spoon, private property, into the inmost recesses of a 2-ounce tin tea caddy, proceeded to make the tea. How slight a thing will disturb the equanimity of our frail minds. The black teapot, being very small and easily filled, ran over while Mrs. Corney was moralizing, and the water slightly scalded Mrs. Corney's hand.
"Drat the pot!" said the worthy matron, setting it down very hastily on the hob. "A little stupid thing that only holds a couple of cups. What use is it of to anybody?"
"Except," said Mrs. Corney, pausing, "except to a poor, desolate creature like me. Oh, dear."
With these words, the matron dropped into her chair and, once more resting her elbow on the table, thought of her solitary fate. The small teapot and the single cup had awakened in her mind sad recollections of Mr. Corney, who had not been dead more than 25 years, and she was overpowered.
"I shall never get another," said Mrs. Corney pettishly. "I shall never get another like him."
Whether this remark bore reference to the husband or the teapot is uncertain. It might have been the latter, for Mrs. Corney looked at it as she spoke and took it up afterwards. She had just tasted her first cup when she was disturbed by a soft tap at the room door.
"Oh, come in with you," said Mrs. Corney sharply. "Some of the old women dying, I suppose. They always die when I'm at meals. Don't stand there letting the cold air in, don't. What's amiss now, eh?"
Nothing, ma'am, nothing,"
replied a man's voice.
"Dear me," exclaimed the matron in a much sweeter tone. "Is that Mr. Bumble?"
"At your service, ma'am,"
said Mr. Bumble, who had been stopping outside to rub his shoes clean and to shake the snow off his coat, and who now made his appearance bearing the cocked hat in one hand and a bundle in the other.
"Shall I shut the door, ma'am?"
The lady modestly hesitated to reply, lest there should be any impropriety in holding an interview with Mr. Bumble with closed doors. Mr. Bumble, taking advantage of the hesitation and being very cold himself, shut it without permission.
"Hard weather, Mr. Bumble," said the matron.
"Hard indeed, ma'am," replied the beadle. "Anti-parochial weather this, ma'am. We have given away, Mrs. Corney, we have given away a matter of 20 quartern loaves and a cheese and a half this very blessed afternoon, and yet them paupers are not contented."
"Of course not. When would they be, Mr. Bumble?" said the matron, sipping her tea.
"When indeed, ma'am," rejoined Mr. Bumble. "Why, here's one man that, in consideration of his wife and large family, has a quartern loaf and a good pound of cheese, full weight. Is he grateful, ma'am? Is he grateful? Not a copper farthing's worth of it. What does he do, ma'am, but ask for a few coals? If it's only a pocket handkerchief full, he says. Coals? What would he do with coals? Toast his cheese with them and then come back for more? That's the way with these people, mum. Give them a apron full of coals today, and they'll come back for another the day after tomorrow, as brazen as alabaster.
The matron expressed her entire concurrence in this intelligible simile, and the beadle went on.
I never, said Mr. Bumble, see anything like the pitch it's got to. The day afore yesterday, a man, you have been a married woman, ma'am, and I may mention it to you, a man with hardly a rag upon his back,
here Mrs. Corney looked at the floor,
goes to our overseer's door when he has got company coming to dinner, and says he must be relieved, Mrs. Corney. As he wouldn't go away and shocked the company very much, our overseer sent him out a pound of potatoes and half a pint of oatmeal. My God, says the ungrateful villain, what's the use of this to me? You might as well give me a pair of iron spectacles. Very good, says our overseer, taking him away again. You won't get anything else here. Then I'll die in the streets, says the vagrant. Oh, no, you won't, says our overseer.
Oh, that was very good. So like Mr. Granite, wasn't it? Interposed the matron. Well, Mr. Bumble?
Well, ma'am, rejoined the beadle. He went away, and he did die in the streets. There's an obstinate pauper for you.
It beats anything I could have believed, observed the matron emphatically. But don't you think out-of-door relief a very bad thing anyway, Mr. Bumble? You're a gentleman of experience and ought to know. Come.
Mrs. Corney, said the beadle, smiling as men smile who are conscious of superior information. Out-of-door relief, properly managed, mum, is the parochial safeguard. The great principle of out-of-door relief is to give the paupers exactly what they don't want, and then they get tired of coming.
Dear me, exclaimed Mrs. Corney. Well, that is a good one, too.
Yes, betwixt you and me, mum, returned Mr. Bumble. That's the great principle, and that's the reason why, if you look at any cases that get into them audacious newspapers, you'll always observe that sick families have been relieved with slices of cheese. That's the rule now, Mrs. Corney, all over the country. But, however, said the beadle, stopping to unpack his bundle, these are official secrets, ma'am, not to be spoken of, except, as I may say, among the parochial officers, such as ourselves. This is the port wine, ma'am, that the board ordered for the infirmary. Real, fresh, genuine port wine, only out of the cask this forenoon. Clear as a bell, and no sediment.
Having held the first bottle up to the light and shaken it well to test its excellence, Mr. Bumble placed them both on the top of a chest of drawers, folded the handkerchief in which they had been wrapped, put it carefully in his pocket, and took up his hat as if to go.
"You'll have a very cold walk, Mr. Bumble," said the matron.
"It blows, mum," replied Mr. Bumble, turning up his coat collar, "enough to cut one's ears off."
The matron looked from the little kettle to the beadle, who was moving towards the door. And as the beadle coughed, preparatory to bidding her good night, bashfully inquired whether he wouldn't take a cup of tea? Mr. Bumble instantaneously turned back his collar again, laid his hat and stick upon a chair, and drew another chair up to the table. As he slowly seated himself, he looked at the lady. She fixed her eyes upon the little teapot. Mr. Bumble coughed again and slightly smiled. Mrs. Corney rose to get another cup and saucer from the closet. As she sat down, her eyes once again encountered those of the gallant beadle. She coloured and applied herself to the task of making his tea. Again Mr. Bumble coughed, louder this time than he had coughed yet.
"Sweet, Mr. Bumble?" inquired the matron, taking up the sugar basin.
"Very sweet indeed, mum," replied Mr. Bumble.
He fixed his eyes on Mrs. Corney as he said this, and if ever a beadle looked tender, Mr. Bumble was that beadle at that moment. The tea was made and handed in silence. Mr. Bumble, having spread a handkerchief over his knees to prevent the crumbs from sullying the splendour of his shorts, began to eat and drink, varying these amusements occasionally by fetching a deep sigh, which, however, had no injurious effect upon his appetite, but, on the contrary, rather seemed to facilitate his operations in the tea and toast department.
"You have a cat, mum, I see," said Mr. Bumble,
glancing at one who, in the centre of her family, was basking before the fire.
"And kittens, too, I declare."
"I am so fond of them, Mr. Bumble, you can't think," replied the matron. "They're so happy, so frolicsome, and so cheerful that they are quite companions for me."
"Very nice animals, mum," replied Mr. Bumble approvingly. "So very domestic."
"Oh, yes," rejoined the matron with enthusiasm. "So fond of their home, too, that it's quite a pleasure, I'm sure."
"Mrs. Corney, ma'am," said Mr. Bumble slowly, and marking the time with his teaspoon, "I mean to say this, ma'am, that any cat or kitten that could live with you, ma'am, and not be fond of its home, must be a ass, ma'am."
"Oh, Mr. Bumble," remonstrated Mrs. Corney.
"It's of no use disguising facts, mum," said Mr. Bumble,
slowly flourishing the teaspoon with a kind of amorous dignity which made him doubly impressive.
"I would drown it myself with pleasure."
"Then you're a cruel man,"
said the matron vivaciously, as she held out her hand for the beadle's cup,
"and a very hard-hearted man besides."
"Hard-hearted, mum?" said Mr. Bumble. "Hard?"
Mr. Bumble resigned his cup without another word, squeezed Mrs. Corney's little finger as she took it, and inflicting two open-handed slaps upon his laced waistcoat, gave a mighty sigh and hitched his chair a very little morsel farther from the fire. It was a round table, and as Mrs. Corney and Mr. Bumble had been sitting opposite each other, with no great space between them, and fronting the fire, it will be seen that Mr. Bumble, in receding from the fire and still keeping at the table, increased the distance between himself and Mrs. Corney, which proceeding some prudent readers will doubtless be disposed to admire and to consider an act of great heroism on Mr. Bumble's part, he being in some sort tempted by time, place, and opportunity to give utterance to certain soft nothings, which, however well they may become the lips of the light and thoughtless, do seem immeasurably beneath the dignity of judges of the land, members of parliament, ministers of state, lord mayors, and other great public functionaries, but more particularly beneath the stateliness and gravity of a beadle, who, as is well known, should be the sternest and most inflexible among them all. Whatever were Mr. Bumble's intentions, however, and no doubt they were of the best, it unfortunately happened, as has been twice before remarked, that the table was a round one. Consequently, Mr. Bumble, moving his chair by little and little, soon began to diminish the distance between himself and the matron, and continuing to travel round the outer edge of the circle, brought his chair in time close to that in which the matron was seated. Indeed, the two chairs touched, and when they did so, Mr. Bumble stopped. Now, if the matron had moved her chair to the right, she would have been scorched by the fire, and if to the left, she must have fallen into Mr. Bumble's arms. So, being a discreet matron, and no doubt foreseeing these consequences at a glance, she remained where she was, and handed Mr. Bumble another cup of tea.
"Hard-hearted, Mrs. Corney,"
said Mr. Bumble, stirring his tea and looking up into the matron's face.
"Are you hard-hearted, Mrs. Corney?"
"Dear me," exclaimed the matron. "What a very curious question from a single man. What can you want to know for, Mr. Bumble?"
The beadle drank his tea to the last drop, finished a piece of toast, whisked the crumbs off his knees, wiped his lips, and deliberately kissed the matron.
"Mr. Bumble!" cried the discreet lady in a whisper, for the fright was so great that she had quite lost her voice. "Mr. Bumble! I shall scream!"
Mr. Bumble made no reply, but in a slow and dignified manner put his arm round the matron's waist. As the lady had stated her intention of screaming, of course she would have screamed at this additional boldness, but that the exertion was rendered unnecessary by a hasty knocking at the door, which was no sooner heard than Mr. Bumble darted with much agility to the wine bottles and began dusting them with great violence, while the matron sharply demanded who was there. It is worthy of remark, as a curious physical instance of the efficacy of a sudden surprise in counteracting the effects of extreme fear, that her voice had quite recovered all its official asperity.
"If you please, mistress," said a withered old female pauper, hideously ugly, putting her head in at the door. "Old Sally is a-going fast."
"Well, what's that to me?" angrily demanded the matron. "I can't keep her alive, can I?"
No, mistress," replied the old woman, raising her hand. "Nobody can. She's far beyond the reach of help. I've seen a many people die, little babes and great strong men, and I know when deaths are coming well enough. But she's troubled in her mind, and when the fits are not on her, and that's not often, for she is dying very hard, she says she has got something to tell, which you must hear. She'll never die till you come, mistress."
At this intelligence, the worthy Mrs. Corney muttered a variety of invectives against old women who couldn't even die without purposely annoying their betters, and, muffling herself in a thick shawl which she hastily caught up, briefly requested Mr. Bumble to stay till she came back, lest anything particular should occur. Bidding the messenger walk fast and not be all night hobbling up the stairs, she followed her from the room with a very ill grace, scolding all the way. Mr. Bumble's conduct on being left to himself was rather inexplicable. He opened the closet, counted the teaspoons, weighed the sugar tongs, closely inspected a silver milk pot to ascertain that it was of the genuine metal, and, having satisfied his curiosity on these points, put on his cocked hat corner-wise, and danced with much gravity four distinct times round the table. Having gone through this very extraordinary performance, he took off the cocked hat again, and, spreading himself before the fire with his back towards it, seemed to be mentally engaged in taking an exact inventory of the furniture. Chapter 24 treats of a very poor subject, but is a short one and may be found of importance in this history. It was no unfit messenger of death who had disturbed the quiet of the matron's room. Her body was bent by age, her limbs trembled with palsy, her face distorted into a mumbling leer resembled more the grotesque shaping of some wild pencil than the work of nature's hand. Alas, how few of nature's faces are left alone to gladden us with their beauty. The cares and sorrows and hungerings of the world change them as they change hearts, and it is only when those passions sleep and have lost their hold forever that the troubled clouds pass off and leave heaven's surface clear. It is a common thing for the countenances of the dead, even in that fixed and rigid state, to subside into the long-forgotten expression of sleeping infancy, and settle into the very look of early life. So calm, so peaceful do they grow again, that those who knew them in their happy childhood kneel by the coffin's side in awe, and see the angel even upon earth. The old crone tottered along the passages and up the stairs, muttering some indistinct answers to the chidings of her companion. Being at length compelled to pause for breath, she gave the light into her hand and remained behind to follow as she might, while the more nimble superior made her way to the room where the sick woman lay. It was a bare garret room, with a dim light burning at the farther end. There was another old woman watching by the bed. The parish apothecary's apprentice was standing by the fire, making a toothpick out of a quill. "Cold night, Mrs. Corney," said this young gentleman, as the matron entered. "Very cold indeed, sir," replied the mistress, in her most civil tones, and dropping a curtsy as she spoke. "You should get better colds out of your contractors," said the apothecary's deputy, breaking a lump on the top of the fire with a rusty poker. "These are not at all the sort of thing for a cold night.
"They're the board's choosing, sir," returned the matron. "The least they could do would be to keep us pretty warm, for our places are hard enough."
The conversation was here interrupted by a moan from the sick woman.
"Oh," said the young man, turning his face towards the bed, as if he had previously quite forgotten the patient. "It's all UP there, Mrs. Corney."
Is it, sir?"
asked the matron. "If she lasts a couple of hours, I shall be surprised," said the apothecary's apprentice, intent upon the toothpick's point. "It's a break-up of the system altogether. Is she dozing, old lady?"
The attendant stooped over the bed to ascertain, and nodded in the affirmative.
"Then perhaps she'll go off in that way, if you don't make a row," said the young man. "Put the light on the floor. She won't see it there."
The attendant did as she was told, shaking her head meanwhile to intimate that the woman would not die so easily. Having done so, she resumed her seat by the side of the other nurse, who had by this time returned. The mistress, with an expression of impatience, wrapped herself in her shawl and sat at the foot of the bed. The apothecary's apprentice, having completed the manufacture of the toothpick, planted himself in front of the fire and made good use of it for 10 minutes or so, when, apparently growing rather dull, he wished Mrs. Corney joy of her job and took himself off on tiptoe. When they had sat in silence for some time, the two old women rose from the bed and, crouching over the fire, held out their withered hands to catch the heat. The flame threw a ghastly light on their shrivelled faces and made their ugliness appear terrible as, in this position, they began to converse in a low voice.
"Did she say any more, Annie dear, while I was gone?"
inquired the messenger.
"Not a word," replied the other. "She plucked and tore at her arms for a little time, but I held her hands and she soon dropped off. She hasn't much strength in her, so I easily kept her quiet. I ain't so weak for an old woman, although I am on parish allowance. No, no. Did she drink the hot wine the doctor said she was to have?"
demanded the first.
"I tried to get it down," rejoined the other, "but her teeth were tight set, and she clenched the mug so hard that it was as much as I could do to get it back again. So I drank it, and it did me good."
Looking cautiously round, to ascertain that they were not overheard, the two hags cowered nearer to the fire and chuckled heartily.
"I mind the time," said the first speaker, "when she would have done the same and made rare fun of it afterwards." "Aye, that she would," rejoined the other. "She had a merry heart. A many, many beautiful corpses she laid out, as nice and neat as waxwork. My old eyes have seen them. Aye, and these old hands touched them too, for I've helped her scores of times."
Stretching forth her trembling fingers as she spoke, the old creature shook them exultingly before her face, and fumbling in her pocket, brought out an old time-discoloured tin snuff-box, from which she shook a few grains into the outstretched palm of her companion, and a few more into her own. While they were thus employed, the matron, who had been impatiently watching until the dying woman should awaken from her stupor, joined them by the fire and sharply asked how long she was to wait.
"Not long, mistress," replied the second woman, looking up into her face. "We have none of us long to wait for death. Patience, patience. He'll be here soon enough for us all."
"Hold your tongue, you doting idiot," said the matron sternly. "You, Martha, tell me, has she been in this way before?"
"Often,"
answered the first woman.
"But will never be again,"
added the second one.
"That is, she'll never wake again but once. And mind, mistress, that won't be for long."
"Long or short," said the matron snappishly, "she won't find me here when she does wake. Take care, both of you, how you worry me again for nothing. It's no part of my duty to see all the old women in the house die, and I won't, that's more. Mind that, you impudent old harridans. If you make a fool of me again, I'll soon cure you, I warrant you."
She was bouncing away when a cry from the two women who had turned towards the bed caused her to look round. The patient had raised herself upright and was stretching her arms towards them.
"Who's that?"
she cried in a hollow voice.
"Hush, hush," said one of the women, stooping over her. "Lie down, lie down."
"I'll never lie down again alive,"
said the woman, struggling.
"I will tell her. Come here, nearer. Let me whisper in your ear.
She clutched the matron by the arm, and forcing her into a chair by the bedside, was about to speak, when, looking round, she caught sight of the two old women bending forward in the attitude of eager listeners.
"Turn them away," said the old woman drowsily. "Make haste, make haste."
The two old crones, chiming in together, began pouring out many piteous lamentations that the poor dear was too far gone to know her best friends, and were uttering sundry protestations that they would never leave her, when the superior pushed them from the room, closed the door, and returned to the bedside. On being excluded, the old ladies changed their tone and cried through the keyhole that old Sally was drunk, which indeed was not unlikely, since in addition to a moderate dose of opium prescribed by the apothecary, she was labouring under the effects of a final taste of gin and water which had been privily administered in the openness of their hearts by the worthy old ladies themselves.
"Now, listen to me,"
said the dying woman aloud, as if making a great effort to revive one latent spark of energy.
"In this very room, in this very bed, I once nursed a pretty young creature that was brought into the house with her feet cut and bruised with walking, and all soiled with dust and blood. She gave birth to a boy and died. Let me think. What was the year again?"
"Never mind the year," said the impatient auditor. "What about her?"
"I,"
murmured the sick woman, relapsing into her former drowsy state.
"What about her? What about... I know!"
she cried, jumping fiercely up, her face flushed and her eyes starting from her head.
"I robbed her. So I did. She wasn't cold. I tell you, she wasn't cold when I stole it."
"Stole what, for God's sake?" cried the matron, with a gesture as if she would call for help.
"It,"
replied the woman, laying her hand over the other's mouth.
"The only thing she had. She wanted clothes to keep her warm and food to eat, but she had kept it safe and had it in her bosom. It was gold, I tell you, rich gold that might have saved her life."
"Gold?" echoed the matron, bending eagerly over the woman as she fell back. "Go on, go on, yes. What of it? Who was the mother? When was it?"
"She charged me to keep it safe," replied the woman with a groan, "and trusted me as the only woman about her. I stole it in my heart when she first showed it me hanging round her neck, and the child's death, perhaps, is on me besides. They would have treated him better if they had known it all."
"Known what?" asked the other. "Speak!"
"The boy grew so like his mother," said the woman, rambling on and not heeding the question, "that I could never forget it when I saw his face. Poor girl, poor girl. She was so young, too. Such a gentle lamb. Wait, there's more to tell. I have not told you all, have I?"
No, replied the matron, inclining her head to catch the words as they came more faintly from the dying woman. "Be quick, or it may be too late."
"The mother,"
said the woman, making a more violent effort than before.
"The mother, when the pains of death first came upon her, whispered in my ear that if her baby was born alive and thrived, the day might come when it would not feel so much disgraced to hear its poor young mother named. And, oh my God," she said, folding her thin hands together, "whether it be boy or girl, raise up some friends for it in this troubled world and take pity upon a lonely, desolate child, abandoned to its mercy."
"The boy's name?" demanded the matron.
"They called him Oliver," replied the woman feebly. "The gold I stole was..."
"Yes, yes, what?" cried the other.
She was bending eagerly over the woman to hear her reply, but drew back instinctively as she once again rose, slowly and stiffly, into a sitting posture, then, clutching the coverlid with both hands, muttered some indistinct sounds in her throat, and fell lifeless on the bed.
"Stone dead," said one of the old women, hurrying in as soon as the door was opened.
"And nothing to tell, after all," rejoined the matron, walking carelessly away.
The two crones, to all appearance too busily occupied in the preparations for their dreadful duties to make any reply, were left alone, hovering about the body. Chapter 25, wherein this history reverts to Mr. Fagin and company. While these things were passing in the country workhouse, Mr. Fagin sat in the old den, the same from which Oliver had been removed by the girl, brooding over a dull, smoky fire. He held a pair of bellows upon his knee, with which he had apparently been endeavouring to rouse it into more cheerful action. But he had fallen into deep thought, and with his arms folded on them, and his chin resting on his thumbs, fixed his eyes abstractedly on the rusty bars. At the table behind him sat the Artful Dodger, Master Charles Bates, and Mr. Chitling, all intent upon a game of whist, the Artful taking dummy against Master Bates and Mr. Chitling. The countenance of the first-named gentleman, peculiarly intelligent at all times, acquired great additional interest from his close observance of the game and his attentive perusal of Mr. Chitling's hand, upon which, from time to time, as occasion served, he bestowed a variety of earnest glances, wisely regulating his own play by the result of his observations upon his neighbour's cards. It being a cold night, the Dodger wore his hat, as indeed was often his custom within doors. He also sustained a clay pipe between his teeth, which he only removed for a brief space when he deemed it necessary to apply for refreshment to a quart pot upon the table, which stood ready filled with gin and water for the accommodation of the company. Master Bates was also attentive to the play, but being of a more excitable nature than his accomplished friend, it was observable that he more frequently applied himself to the gin and water, and, moreover, indulged in many jests and irrelevant remarks, all highly unbecoming a scientific rubber. Indeed, the Artful, presuming upon their close attachment, more than once took occasion to reason gravely with his companion upon these improprieties, all of which remonstrances Master Bates received in extremely good part, merely requesting his friend to be blowed, or to insert his head in a sack, or replying with some other neatly turned witticism of a similar kind, the happy application of which excited considerable admiration in the mind of Mr. Chitling. It was remarkable that the latter gentleman and his partner invariably lost, and that the circumstance, so far from angering Master Bates, appeared to afford him the highest amusement, inasmuch as he laughed most uproariously at the end of every deal, and protested that he had never seen such a jolly game in all his born days. "That's two doubles and the rub," said Mr. Chitling with a very long face, as he drew half a crown from his waistcoat pocket. "I never see such a fellow as you, Jack. You win everything. Even when we've good cards, Charlie and I can't make nothing of 'em." Either the matter or the manner of this remark, which was made very ruefully, delighted Charlie Bates so much that his consequent shout of laughter roused the Jew from his reverie and induced him to inquire what was the matter. "Matter, Fagin!" cried Charlie. "I wish you had watched the play. Tommy Chitling hasn't won a point, and I went partners with him against the Artful and Dumb." "Aye, aye," said the Jew with a grin, which sufficiently demonstrated that he was at no loss to understand the reason. "Try 'em again, Tom, try 'em again."
"No more of it for me, thank ye, Fagin," replied Mr. Chitling. "I've had enough. That 'ere Dodger's such a run of luck, there's no standing again him."
"Ha, ha, my dear," replied the Jew. "You must get up very early in the morning to win against the Dodger."
"Morning," said Charlie Bates, "you must put your boots on overnight and have a telescope at each eye and a opera glass between your shoulders if you want to come over him."
Mr. Dawkins received these handsome compliments with much philosophy and offered to cut any gentleman in company for the first picture card at a shilling a time. Nobody accepting the challenge, and his pipe being by this time smoked out, he proceeded to amuse himself by sketching a ground plan of Newgate on the table with the piece of chalk which had served him in lieu of counters, whistling meantime with peculiar shrillness.
"How precious dull you are, Tommy," said the Dodger, stopping short when there had been a long silence, and addressing Mr. Chitling. "What do you think he's thinking of, Fagin?"
"How should I know, my dear?" replied the Jew, looking round as he plied the bellows. "About his losses, maybe, or the little retirement in the country that he's just left, eh? Is that it, my dear?"
"Not a bit of it," replied the Dodger, stopping the subject of discourse.